They're more than 30 times closer to each other than we are to our next-door neighbor. We're out in the boonies, and I don't mean Laredo. They've got next-door neighbors. And from a planet around one, looking at the other, it's visible all day long. That'd be kind of neat. And they're so close, you could directly observe planets around them, and you could tell whether there's life or not by the characteristics of the atmospheres around the planets. And you'd have far more incentive to develop interstellar travel when you got a next-door neighbor than if you're out in the boonies. So that's just down the street, and we have a situation that's drastically different than ours, from ours. So, okay, you've seen the rest of this, or at least I've told you about it. Just think about the fact that we spend $1 trillion a year on the military. How many starving kids could we feed with that $1 trillion a year? That says a lot about us, where our priorities are, doesn't it? Okay, now, I mentioned nuclear energy just to give you some idea of what's possible. That's a nuclear-powered submarine. First one was the Nautilus, 1956. Can go around the world underwater without surfacing. They take periscope leave when they go by Detroit, I'm told. Around the world without refueling. Submarines during the war, World War II, were really surface ships that could spend maybe a day underwater. They needed oxygen for the engines, the diesel engines. You can make enough for the people, but not enough for the engines. Well, went a little bit beyond that. That's a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. I don't know who painted that stuff on there, but we have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, huge monsters, that can operate for 18 years without refueling. Think about that for a minute. How many gallons of fuel don't get used because we have these aircraft carriers? And they've changed the whole character of war because you can go full steam ahead. In a normal non-nuclear carrier, the faster you go, the more fuel you're using. And pretty soon you got a need for more fuel, but during war, it's a little hard to get it. So 18 years is kind of neat when you get down to it. Most people don't know about this, of course, and it illustrates something else. If you spend any time on the whole question of UFOs, you know there are motherships, so-called space carriers, if you will, huge things, which carry lots of little small guys. Now, look at the picture. There's a whole bunch of little airplanes there. They don't work worth a darn on the water, and the carrier obviously doesn't work in the sky very well. The little airplanes need refueling every couple hours. Not 18 years. So you'd expect to get from another star system to ours. You'd use the mothership. Between the stars, a lot of nothing. Probably a big fusion-powered device. When you get near the atmosphere, going the speed of light doesn't do you much good. It takes a seventh of a second to go around the planet. How do you meet somebody for lunch going that fast? You know. And you have the problems of the atmosphere and stuff like that, high gravity and all that sort of thing. So you got the little ones, which land, are seen all over the planet, produce physical trace cases, and you got the big motherships. They don't land, but they're the carriers, the space carriers, if you will. Perfectly reasonable. Incidentally, I'm not saying fusion is the only thing that would work for deep space travel. I'm saying we know it would work. Undoubtedly, my mantra is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You got to change how you do things. A laser is not just a better light bulb. Entirely different physics. That's a nuclear-powered rocket engine built by Los Alamos. It's big brother, a little larger. The 2B operates at a power level of 4,400 megawatts. And you say, what does that mean? A Grand Coulee Dam runs about 4,000 megawatts. a little larger than this thing, which is only this big. This was operated back in the 60s, for goodness sakes. So it's not a new fly-by-night idea. The normal response from the ancient academics and fossilized physicists who say there's nothing to flying saucers is, it's impossible, isn't it? And the answer is, no, it's not. You've got to change how you do things. And I've co-authored a book, which isn't here because my box didn't arrive. Blame the post office. Blame me for not sending it earlier. Science was wrong. 14 chapters. Each one of them really focused around a stupid thing said by a smart scientist. There's a quote here later of, you know, man can't fly. The British Astronomer Royal say space travel is utter bilge a year before Sputnik went up. And there's a whole long list of these. It's impossible. Meaning, I don't know how to do it, therefore nobody knows how to do it because I'm smart. But there are other smart people, probably much smarter, really. So that's the kind of thinking you got to watch out for. Everything we've ever accomplished has been said to be impossible by somebody who didn't know how to do it. Now, I throw in this for any, if there are any scientists here, fusion reactions. Nuclear fusion. Every civilization joins the Galactic Federation, so to speak, once it figures out how its star works. That's the engine of the solar system. We used to think it worked by burning gas, because what else could there be? Well, there's nuclear fusion. And instead of a star lasting a few million years, it lasts billions of years. And every star out there works by nuclear fusion. And that top line there, helium-3. The lightest gas is hydrogen. The next lightest is helium. And they're also the two most abundant substances in the universe. Wherever you're going to go, you may have trouble finding uranium because it's very heavy. You'll find hydrogen and helium everywhere. If you react the right stuff in the right way, you get charged particles, which can be directed by electric and magnetic fields, which is kind of nice. You also produce neutrons, which go off in all different directions, and it's pretty hard to get them all to go out the back end of the rocket. Because some are going this way, that way, the other way. But if they're charged particles, you can direct them with electric and magnetic fields. And so you can kick them out the back end. Now, you'll notice a little initials up there. 18.3 MeV. That's million electron volts. Now, to give you some grasp of this, normal chemical reactions, you light a match, your car engines, etc., use a few electron volts, produce a few electron volts. A few, 5 to 10, 20, that sort of thing. This reaction, 18 million electron volts. Now you got a ball game. Powerful. Different. These are things we know about. Again, I'm not saying there aren't better ways of doing things. I'm just too ignorant to know what the better things are. But you have to expect that there will be better things if we don't destroy ourselves first, because that's the way it's always been. There are clever people out there. There's some less clever people who try to suppress the clever people. That's a different problem. Okay, so nuclear fusion is a word you should keep in mind. That's what produces the energy in the sun and in all the other stars. And every advanced civilization will know about nuclear fusion. The first H-bomb, Mike, the fireball was 3 miles wide, incidentally. You wonder what the aliens thought when they saw that happening. What are these idiots up to now? I think would be a natural reaction. That gives you some of the numbers I've already given you. People say, why would they come here? Why don't they land on the White House lawn? I hate to tell you this, but the President of the United States doesn't speak for 7 billion Earthlings. There are times when he doesn't speak for 310 million Americans. And it's a no-fly zone. There were plenty of sightings over Washington in the summer of 1952. Huge press conference. They were seen on radar. They were chased away by planes. Major event. they sure didn't try to land, risking life and limb. Why are they concerned about us? My book, Flying Saucers and Science, has 20 reasons for coming here. Honeymoon capital, this corner of the galaxy, you know. They're graduate students doing their research on the development of a primitive society. They're mining goodies here. Why would anybody go that far to mine anything? Well, you know, the price of gold right now. Gold ore is worth mining. If there's a gram of gold, a gram per ton of ore, there are a lot of things that are very valuable on this planet. And there are a lot of things that we didn't know were valuable. Uranium, it was discovered quite a while ago, but the only thing that was being used for 100 years ago was yellow glaze on table pottery. That's illegal now. It's radioactive. Not a good idea because you might dissolve some of the surface, you know. But we didn't know it was valuable. The rare earths that make the Prius possible. China's gathered up most of the rare earths on the planet. The Navy uses zirconium. Very crucial for all those nuclear-powered ships. Whoever did anything with zirconium? Air Force is using titanium. They had to develop a whole new industry. So who knows what else, because we're the densest planet in the solar system. I'm not talking about the people, probably true too. But densest planet means we got more heavy metals here than any place else in the solar system. Uranium, rhenium, osmium, other heavy metals, even heavier than gold. They're rare in the universe. And another reason for aliens to traipse about, we have learned that crazy things happen in solar systems. A big asteroid comes down and beats the heck out of a planet. Well, you better find a new home, maybe. So you always have to have a storm cellar, so to speak. Plus a place for the overflow of population before you learn to control that. Things aren't static, in other words. So you expect them to check us out. But a particular concern is we're reaching out and we are evil. Maybe that's the right word to use. If you were an alien, you wouldn't want us out there. Now, a quick look at sources of information, which the noisy negativists never talk about. Biggest study ever done for the United States Air Force, Project Blue Book, Special Report 14. Completed in 1955, a press release went out. They didn't release the report. Don't want to tell the public too much, you know. They looked at 3,201 sightings. This is Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. There are 250 charts, tables, graphs, and maps, and I can't sell you a copy because I sold who I had yesterday. This is for those who think that almost all sightings can be explained. This is a breakdown of those 3,201 sightings. Notice the bottom line. The unknowns, the only ones we're interested in, 21.5%. And if you're wondering, that's psychological manifestations. 1.5%. Now, everybody, some people will say that, oh, look, the only people who see UFOs are kooks. That's what the British Astronomer Royal said a couple months ago. No evidence, no data, no fact to support that nonsense. But he got worldwide publicity. Only kooks see UFOs. Didn't seem to know about the pilot sightings. I presume he doesn't travel around. There's an organization that's collected well over 1,000 sightings by pilots. There are plenty of sightings by astronomers. He's the British Astronomer Royal. You'd think he'd trust his fellow astronomers. He won't even acknowledge that they've ever seen a UFO. Now, here's what the Secretary of the Air Force said. On the basis of this study, we believe that no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. I feel certain that even the unknown 3% could have been explained as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been obtained. He said 3%. I had a copy of the report in my hand when I found this back in 1960 or so. 3% is not rounded off to 21.5. I don't care how careless your arithmetic is. And there's a separate category. Notice the category before the bottom, insufficient information. By definition, if there wasn't enough data available about a sighting, it had to be listed as insufficient information. It was not an unknown. People say to me, why does the Air Force keep lying? Because it works. Now, here's what my college classmate for 3 years, Carl Sagan, said. The reliable cases are uninteresting, and the interesting cases are unreliable. Unfortunately, there are no cases that are both reliable and interesting. That's what he said. Any evidence provided? Any reference? No, of course not. That's not true. Here's a quality evaluation. Of the best cases, 35% were unknown. Of the poorest cases, only 18.3% were unknown. Just the opposite of what Carl said. It's exactly what you'd expect if the unknowns were really something different. I'd already published this data. As a matter of fact, my congressional testimony has it. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. That's one of four major rules for debunkers. What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them, is another. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier and nobody will know the difference. And do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too much trouble, and who's going to know the difference? Congressional hearings. You probably never heard about them. They were on my birthday, July 29th, 1968. I wasn't born that year, obviously. But 12 scientists provided testimony, 6 in person, 6 in writing. I was the youngest of the group and the only one without a Ph.D. What do you need a piled higher and deeper degree for, with apologies to the previous speaker? outstanding, there's a paper here by Dr. James E. McDonald, information on 41 separate cases, multiple witness radar visual sightings, pilot sightings, sightings by astronomers, sightings over big cities, all kinds of outstanding stuff. It's listed on my free list because I ran out of copies to sell you. But anybody who thinks there aren't any good cases, you know, a typical good case, an RB-47 reconnaissance bomber seen over the Gulf of Mexico, then over Texas and over Oklahoma. Sighting lasted for an hour. The object station kept with them and then circled around them, which is a neat trick. This is back in the 50s. 6 highly trained crew members who saw it visually, saw it on their radar, picked up a signal from it, radioed the ground, 2 targets, tracked them as they moved right along. Jim McDonald talked to all 6 of the witnesses. Very consistent sighting, consistent testimony. And if you can't trust these guys, I mean, they're the reconnaissance bombers. They're supposed to be keeping track of what's going on out there. A lot of good cases like that. The University of Colorado study, many people think, oh, they showed there weren't any UFOs, didn't they? No. Oh, they made noises that made it sound like that. Press release said, no benefit to science from study of UFOs. UFOs nonsense, scientists says. That's what the press said. A special UFO subcommittee of the world's largest group of space scientists, American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, found that 30% of the 117 cases studied in detail could not be explained. Press never told you that, though. Dr. J. Allen Hynek. Now, you'd think that astronomer royal would have at least referred to the work of Dr. Hynek, an astronomer, head of the astronomy department at Northwestern University, the Air Force Project Blue Book scientific consultant on UFOs for 20 years, mind you. And in this book has plenty of sightings by astronomers. But, of course, the noisy negativists never mentioned the book, even the astronomers. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. Now, if you want a lot of information, you can go to Flying Saucers Are Real, my DVD. I think it's 168 minutes long. Some of it filmed at Cape Kennedy. Then there was the Roswell Report, case closed. One of my favorite book works of fiction. Well, you know, the crazy thing, the Air Force put out 2 volumes. It never said anything. And then all of a sudden, because Congressman Stephen Schiff was pushing to get more information about Roswell out, they put together this, the first volume is like a little over 2 inches thick. And has lies about me, which I resent. And they said in there they weren't going to say anything more. That was 1994. Well, they lied just before the 50th anniversary of Roswell. We had 300 newsmen down in Roswell for that, 1997. They issued the Roswell report, case closed. They came up with the silliest explanation yet. The reason people talked about bodies at Roswell is that we were dropping crash test dummies all over New Mexico. Well, they did drop a number of crash test dummies. This is right out of their report. I talked to the man on the right. The dummy's the one in the middle, in case you're wondering. You'll notice he's in a flight suit. The idea of dropping the dummies is because if you want to eject pilots from a high-performance aircraft at high speed, if you want to jump out of a balloon, like happened that very long ago, the clothing makes a difference in how quickly you'd freeze, the drag, the heating, all this sort of thing. Now, there's two major problems with this explanation. Didn't stop the New York Times from putting it on the front page. One is, no dummies were dropped until after 1953. Roswell happened in 1947. So we have time travel for crash test dummies. The second thing is, if you'll notice, and I talked to the colonel who's there, Madsen, in person. The Air Force didn't bother. There's pictures in the book, but they didn't bother to talk to him. He stressed to me that for the test to be meaningful, the dummies had to be 6 feet tall and 175 pounds. Now, how do you morph that down to a little guy 4 feet tall with a big head? You're telling me a New Mexican farmer or rancher down there is going to find one? Oh, my goodness, we've been invaded by aliens. That looked like the thing in the middle there. That's absurd. Even forgetting about the time travel. They got away with it. Lying works for the government when it comes to UFOs. Here's a line I like. Newcomb was the greatest American astronomer of the 19th century. When he died in the early 1900s, his funeral was attended by the President of the United States. Here's what he said. The demonstration that no possible combination of known substances, known forms of machinery, and known forms of force can be united in a practical machine by which man shall fly long distances through the air seems to this writer as complete as it is possible for the demonstration of any physical fact to be. Now, the date of that was October 1903. The Wright brothers' first flight was 2 months later. He obviously didn't know what he was talking about. Well, he did put in a kicker, known forms of this or that. Why did he think he knew what all those forms might be? His business wasn't aviation. But when a guy like this stands up and says something so stupid, it keeps a lot of other people from investing the money to investigate. Has a strong negative effect on development. There's Seth Shostak is with the SETI Institute. We each gave 3 lectures on the Queen Elizabeth II on its last voyage from England to New York. We were rewarded by the British UFO magazine. We each attended the other lectures. We were friendly. He attended mine, and in the course of mine, I talked about 5 large-scale scientific studies, said what was in them, asked how many people there had read it. Usually it's 2% or so. He hadn't read any of them. We debated on coast-to-coast radio. He still hadn't read any. He did admit a couple years later that he had a copy of my book, Flying Saucers and Science, on his nightstand. He didn't say he'd read it. And it's no wonder I won the debate. 57%, he got 33%, and 10% said, I don't know. SETI. Now, you understand, if aliens are landing here, who needs to listen with radio telescopes? Maybe you better learn sign language. They will never refer to the large-scale scientific UFO studies, to facts, to data, to evidence. They know nothing about interstellar travel. Jill Tarter, she was the model for Jodie Foster's Contact, the movie of the book written by Carl Sagan. And she just recently resigned in order to go full-time to fundraising. She's 68. Bright gal, no question. When you're so close to being onto something so important, you can't just stop, she said. It'll be a earth-shaking event when we make contact. A couple of years back, she said, the nearest civilization might be as close as 1,000 light years. And when we make contact, it'll change everything. They may help us solve our problems. Can't you see the conversation? Hey, out there, we need some help with some problems we have here. 2,000 years later, 1,000 years for the message to get out, another 1,000 come out. Hey, what can we do for you guys? Does that make any sense at all? Not as far as I can tell. One of my monthly columns in the MUFON Journal talked about that. Probably made some people angry, but too bad. Stephen Hawking. If advanced life exists, they'll contact us. Aliens haven't contacted us so far. Why did he say that? How does he know whether aliens have contacted us? You'd think they'd say, hey, give us Stephen Hawking, please. We want to talk to somebody smart down there. He doesn't have a security clearance. He thinks that the scientists rule the planet. I've been one a long time, and I never thought that, even when I was working under security. Why would they contact us? Did Columbus send a message? Hey, guys, we're coming to find you out there. Be ready. Want some good food? Oh, the British Astronomer Royal. Yeah, those guys have a real track record of stupidity. He said this to Time magazine about space travel. It's utter bilge. I don't think anybody will ever put up enough money to do such a thing. What good would it do us if we spent the same amount of money on preparing first-class astronomical equipment? We would learn much more about the universe. It is all rather rot. That was a year before Sputnik. And what scientific field has benefited the most from the space program? Astronomy, of course. They finally got up above the atmosphere so we could really see what's going on. But British Astronomer Royal, no higher authority. Oh. We are told that governments can't keep secrets. Seth Shostak said that the proof that governments can't keep secrets is what a lousy job FEMA did on Katrina and how badly the post office is operated. I didn't hear him say anything about the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, the CIA, the DIA, NSA, all these other alphabet soup agencies. They're the ones who keep the secrets. Another great astronomer, Dr. Tyson, head of the planetarium in New York, Hayden Planetarium, in a speech he gave to 1,800 people at Penn State University last year, he said, the proof that governments can't keep secrets is how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia. Think about that for a minute. What a stupid comment to make. It took me 5 years to get a bunch of CIA UFO documents. You'll see one of them up there. You can read six words. I think it's six words on that. And they're not important words. And people say, why don't you just scrape off the black? Because they Xeroxed it first. There's nothing underneath that black. They're not stupid. You can say, think of a lot of other words for the CIA, but stupidity isn't one of them. Another one, just to show you it's not just one. Now, the NSA took a lot longer to release their documents. And they switched, I'm told, because of me, because I used to show those blacked-out documents. So they decided they'd put out whited-out documents. You can read everything but one sentence. I mean, anything. The only thing you can read is one sentence. National Security Agency, this is a top-secret Umbra document. And I've got 156 documents that look much like this. A sentence that you can read, and the rest is supposedly sources and methods. How can you have 97% of a document be sources and methods and 1% and 3% be significant? That makes no sense. But they got away with it. There's no cover-up. I had people call me. Stan, they released those documents. They're not covering up anymore. I said, can you read what's underneath the whiteout or the blackout in the other case? Well, no, then they didn't release them. They're playing games. There's, like I say, 156 documents, pages that I have that look like that. Then there's a very important document from General Carol Bolander. He was given the job in 1969, after the Condon Report had come out recommending that Project Blue Book, the supposedly the only government study, be canceled. He had no previous connection with it. He was an engineer. He worked on the lunar excursion module. Very sharp guy. So he put together the memo that resulted in the closure of Project Blue Book. In it, he said, reports of UFOs which could affect national security, I left some words, are made in accordance with Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146 or Air Force Manual 55-11 and are not part of the Blue Book system. Two paragraphs later, he says, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigating using the procedures established for such purposes. No major news publication has ever reported those words. I found him years after this. We got a hold of this document and talked to him, and I said, I mentioned that I'd worked under security and so forth. I said, sounds like you're saying there are two reporting channels, one for the ones that can affect national security and one for the ones that we just see normally. The example we talked about was if a UFO goes down the runway at a Strategic Air Command base where nuclear weapons are stored, clearly a national security problem. Ain't supposed to be nobody without a clearance going down those runways. If we all go outside here and see a UFO fly over, big deal. MUFON gets 600 reports a month. You know, so not rare. Anyway, he agreed with me, two separate channels. And yet we keep being told by the United States Air Force that we're not doing anything about UFOs, and we can see no threat to the security of the United States. It's a lot more involved than that, and I discuss this in my books. But we're being lied to, folks. There's my book, one of them. And in it, I try to cover the big objections. First chapter deals with all those large-scale scientific studies that the noisy negativists never mention. Second chapter deals with you can get here from there. Maybe I ought to talk about that. I play a little game when I get on campuses. I've given over 700 lectures. And every once in a while, fine. And then one of the students will tell me, Dr. Jones is going to show that you don't know anything. Oh, boy, I like those guys. And so I'll give a talk on flying saucers and physics. And I'll try to talk about several different things, which I don't think they know anything about. I'll talk about the electromagnetic submarine, for example. No moving parts slip silently through the seawater. I'll talk about a whole bunch of things like that. And then I'll get a little straight. I'll say, what's the numerical value of 1G acceleration? You remember one big objection to flying saucers, if there was anybody on board, he'd be smashed against the walls, crushed to death by those enormous accelerations during the right angle turns and so forth. I mean, like the guy is walking around drinking a beer while this is going on. You know, he doesn't wear his seatbelt. Maybe you notice that when the astronauts go up, they're on their back. Ever notice that? And there's a reason, because you can stand far more acceleration back to front than foot to head. Your knee and ankle joints and so forth don't, and hip joints don't work very well if you're getting push like crazy. Anyway, I will ask the students and their professors there casually, what's the numerical value of 1G? And there's a chorus, 9.8 meters per second squared. I say the number is right, but there's nothing that anybody else does in those units. And how do you relate that to a Corvette? And they look at me like I'm talking some foreign language. They say a good value for 1G is 21 miles per hour per second. So at 1G, in 3 seconds, you're going 63 miles an hour. And that's a pretty hot car. Usually it takes 5 or 6 seconds. And they look at me, well, they didn't know that, but that's all right. Then I'll say, what's the speed of light? What are the units for the speed of light? 300,000 kilometers per second. I say, again, how do you relate that to the real world? They don't know. 670 million miles an hour. You say, why is that connected with the real world? Well, Jupiter's 500 million miles away, numbers like that. So the dimensions of the solar system, in other words, about an hour to go good ways out there at the speed of light. I said, now the key question is, how long does it take at 1G to get to the speed of light? It's a multiple choice question. 1,000 years, 100 years, 10 years, 1 year. I won't ask the question here. I'll tell you the answers. A lot of people, this includes the professors and the students, will say 1,000 years. How many think 100 years? Bunch more, some 10, and a few ones. It only takes 1 year at 1G to get close to the speed of light. There's a big difference between 1,000 years and 1 year. And we can stand a lot more. How many G's can we stand? Well, a trained pilot can perform a tracking task while being accelerated at 14 G's for 2 minutes. That's 0 to 36,000 miles an hour in 2 minutes. That's measured data, incidentally. Not on me, but real pilots. And the Apollo command module has a little rocket to get it out of there if there's a fire down at the bottom. It'll give the astronauts 13 G's. And a guy on one of these rocket sleds, a researcher, it got a little faster than it was supposed to get, up to 610 miles an hour, and stopped in 3/4 of a second. That's like 43 G's for 3/4 of a second. He lived to tell the tale. His eyeballs were uncomfortable. What I'm saying is we have data to do things with. It's like typical of the nasty, noisy negativists. In 1940, a great astronomer, Canadian, Dr. Campbell, calculated the required initial launch weight of a rocket able to get a man to the moon. Ha! He said it was nonsense. Pages of equations published in a professional journal. Bottom line, it would have to weigh 1 million tons at liftoff. Isn't that ridiculous? Yeah, the calculation was ridiculous. He made every possible stupid assumption. Assumed a single-stage rocket, limit of 1G acceleration, had to carry a retro rocket to slow down. You fire straight up instead of to the east to take advantage of the Earth. He didn't know about cosmic freeloading. In case you hadn't noticed, the moon has a gravitational field. Why is there a launch window? You want it to come along at just the right time to pull you in the rest of the way. Why should you provide the energy when Mother Nature will do it for you? When we went to the moon, got three guys to the moon and back, initial launch weight was 3,000 tons. He said 1 million tons. Now, if you're going to make a lousy calculation, boy, there's a splendid example of it. I don't know why he thought he should even do the study except to show how smart he was and how wrong it could be. Even Arthur C. Clarke pointed out how wrong Dr. Campbell was. There's another chapter in here that you might find interesting, flying saucers and science fiction. And I talk about three of the great science fiction writers, Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, and Ben Bova, who have all said stupid things about flying saucers. I particularly like Isaac's comment. If aliens were coming here, they'd either make themselves known or they'd hide from us. If they do neither, they're not coming here. Like, he's an expert on alien behavior because he's written science fiction books. Were they tested against reality, Isaac? I don't know. It gets a little disgusting sometimes. There's another chapter on why would anybody come here? And I go through all that sort of stuff. This is about the Majestic 12 documents. They're real. There's three real, 100 and some phony. Oh, they didn't change for daylight saving time. I thought I'm usually not that far off from how long it takes. Okay. This is my book, Top Secret Magic, M-A-J-I-C. Those are the security markings on a roll, on documents in a roll of film we got in the mail, which tell the incredible tale. They're supposedly document a briefing for President-elect Eisenhower, dated 1952. In which it says that President Truman established a group called Operation Majestic 12. With 12 outstanding people, including three of the first directors of Central Intelligence, and half a dozen scientists and generals and so forth. This group, Majestic 12, MJ-12, Magic 12, would be accountable only to the President of the United States. And the briefing was dated November 1952, after the election, November 22nd, I think it was. And the question of whether the document is genuine. Then a whole bunch of other documents came out. Some of them were obviously fraudulent. I spent a lot of time at archives. I've been to 20 archives. If somebody'd pay me, I'd spend full time at those archives. But they won't, so I don't. Anyway, I'm convinced that there are three genuine documents, and they're the most important classified documents ever released to the public. And I got all kinds of attacks from people. Oh, they're obviously fraudulent, Stan, and they'll pick out one that I agree. Oh, yeah, that one's fraudulent, that one's fraudulent, that one's fraudulent. I don't care about the fraudulent ones. It's the real ones that I care about. Now, these people don't go to archives. That's too much trouble. Ex cathedra pronouncements. The documents are fraud because in the date 18 November, 1952, that comma doesn't belong there. It violates the government style manual. If you go to the archives, you'll see all kinds of date formats. This is back when they used typewriters. You're all familiar with typewriters, I hope. I still have one that I use occasionally. Just an old fuddy-duddy, I know. And there, the complaint from Mr. Philip Klass, one of the top debunkers until his death, senior avionics editor for Aviation Week and Space Technology in Washington. So he was a natural to call on when the media needed somebody. And he fulfilled their needs every time. A couple of times on Larry King, at the beginning of the show, he lambasted a book they were talking about. Larry suddenly asked him halfway through the show, did you read this book? No. Twice that happened. How can you express opinions about a book you haven't read? You know. Anyway, Phil challenged me on one of these documents. Perhaps you didn't notice it was done in the large pica type. But I've got nine documents from the National Security Council, which was related here, and they're all done in the small elite type. I will offer you $100 each for every genuine document meeting certain criteria done in the same size and style pica type as that document you say is genuine. Up to a limit of 10, unfortunately. Now, he'd never been to the Eisenhower Library. I've spent weeks there. To make a long story short, I first went to my files and pulled out 20 PICA documents. Most of them didn't meet his criteria, appropriate signatures, etc. But I was teasing him. And he allowed for two of them, and he thought he was home free. Then I was going to the Eisenhower Library anyway, so I picked up 14 more that met all his criteria. Sent him copies and an invoice for $1,000. Limit was 10, see. And he sent me a check. Then he got very mad when I showed a copy of his check and something I wrote. He told everybody about challenging me, nobody about paying me. That's typical of the debunkers. But those documents are important. There's his check. I'm a good guy. I took out some of the banking numbers on there, you see. I've really gone into a lot of those anti-arguments. That's the one that bothered me the most, I suppose, or pleased me the most, depending on how you look at it. But one of the real shockers was that one of the members of this group was Dr. Donald Howard Menzel, a Harvard University professor of astronomy, and a supposed complete debunker about UFOs. He'd written three anti-UFO books. One of them was translated into Russian way back in the 50s. In the first place, everybody else had a high-level security clearance. You could tell from the work they'd been doing. What the heck is Menzel doing with that group? You don't need a security clearance to teach astronomy at Harvard. Last I heard, anyway. That one stumbled. It bothered me. How could Menzel be part of this group? So I found out that all these guys were dead when we got these documents. How convenient, you might say. So I checked with Harvard, and the Harvard archives had a lot of Menzel's papers. It took permission from three different people for me to look at his papers. I went there, discovered to my total shock, because I didn't like him while he was alive. We had a little run-in. I was speaking at Harvard to an engineering alumni group, and I called him early in the day to invite him to the lecture. I gave him my name. Oh, I know all about you, he said, which surprised me. Oh, you saw my congressional testimony next to yours? No. I've seen letters and memos. I still don't know what that meant. You can't be a scientist and believe in flying saucers, he said, at which point I laughed. That made him angry. And I said, look, Dr. Menzel, I didn't call to argue with you. I called out of courtesy to invite you to a lecture on your campus tonight. I don't know whether they've done any publicity outside the group of engineering alumni. Oh, well, of course I won't be there. So I told the story that night, just so they knew I wasn't afraid to take on Dr. Menzel. So the last thing I was in favor of was saying good things about Don Menzel. But when I looked at his papers, holy cow. Turned out, he wrote Jack Kennedy, who had been on the board of overseers at Harvard, that he, Menzel, had a longer continuous association with the super-secret National Security Agency of anybody in the country, more than 30 years at that time, and with its Navy predecessor. When we are properly cleared to each other, I can tell you more about that. And all kinds of other stuff there. So I published a paper, and I got dumped on. Oh, he couldn't lead a double life. Every spy leads a double life. There were three guys in England, Burgess, Philby, and McLean, that worked for MI5, British intelligence. They were all Russian spies. You've got to have a certain amount of the actor in you, and you got to be smart, and these guys were. And Menzel certainly was. It's a long story, but it's told in Top Secret Magic. And I'm still satisfied that three of the documents are genuine and the most important classified documents ever leaked to the public. Not released. These didn't come from Freedom of Information Act requests. That was kind of fun. And as part of that, of course, I have to take pride in the fact that my manuscript, my book, Top Secret Magic, has been optioned for a movie, along with my life story, my memoirs, and so forth, by Bryce Zabel and Donnie Most, who have a Hollywood Stellar Productions. Bryce did Dark Skies. Remember that television program? And he has a nice comment on one of my books. And they're getting good comments in Hollywood. They've done a screenplay, done it over four times. But and all we need now is somebody to come up with the money. They also optioned Witness to Roswell by Don Schmidt and Tom Carey. And it's a combination of these two, you see. Hopefully it'll be like All the President's Men. And maybe a little JFK thrown in. And I want Richard Dreyfuss to play me. He was born in 1947, so it seems appropriate, doesn't it? They're getting closer to the movie, and I just heard a week ago they've had some very good comments. Bryce's Hollywood wheel from people they've showed this to, the manuscript. So if any of you has a few tens of millions of dollars you'd like to make a movie from and get a nice profit from, maybe, contact me. I'll put you in touch. But it would be exciting because the same guys have also optioned my book, Captured, that Kathleen Marden did most of the work for. Kathleen is Betty Hill's niece. And she has done a tremendous job on that book, Captured, and they've optioned that. And so I could have the lucky opportunity, he says, if the movies turn out okay, I might not want to show up in public if they don't, of having two of my books made into movies while I'm alive, he says, hopefully. So that's news from Hollywood. There's Betty and Barney Hill. And that's the star map that shows up in the book. Now, most of you have probably been aware of this through John Fuller's book, Interrupted Journey. Betty, under hypnosis, is reliving how she's asking the leader of this crew on board a saucer up in New Hampshire in 1961 where they're from. I know you're not from around here. understatement of the year. And the guy shows her, I'll call it a hologram, but it's a three-dimensional map. Points of light, which are supposedly stars, and three different kinds of lines, heavy trade routes, occasional expeditions, that sort of thing. And she's looking at this thing, and there are two big stars, size of a nickel, she said. You can see them on the right-hand side of this. And she asked, well, where are you on the map? Wise guy alien says, do you know where you are? I don't know anything about astronomy. How can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at? End of discussion. Well, Dr. Simon, the psychiatrist, who is the strong link in this story, just a bit about him. During the war, he ran a hospital for 3,000 beds for shell shock war veterans. Today we'd say PTSD. The Army actually made a movie, Let There Be Light, starring Dr. Simon, showing how he helped veterans come back to be part of the living. You know, your buddy's head gets blown off next to you in battle. That's not easy to handle. So he was a world-class expert, didn't know much about flying saucers at all. But he has said in writing that the emotional intensity, as they relieved 10 sessions each, this was done separately, as they relived this experience, was as great as that of any of the shell-shock war veterans he worked with. Now, Betty was a social worker. Barney worked for the post office, but was very active in civil rights. He was on the Governor's Civil Rights Commission and so forth. So the book, Kathy has gone through, she has all the tapes, she's Betty's trustee of her estate and so forth. A lot of the materials at the University of New Hampshire. So here's this map. What are you going to do with it? It's in the book. Well, a woman named Marjorie Fish, school teacher in Ohio, read the book, was dubious because she'd studied biology and didn't think the aliens could look anything like us, and Betty had said that they were humanoid. So she visited Betty, went home and built 27 different three-dimensional models of our local galactic neighborhood, if you can believe. The hard part was getting the right distance data for the stars, because the astronomers aren't going anywhere. They don't care how far away they are, just what angle. Two angles, there's the star. It was 20 light years or 40 light years, doesn't matter. But if you're trying to see if there's a three-dimensional pattern that matches a two-dimensional pattern, you better get the distances right. I was asked to help her. There's one of her models. Painstaking work to do this. This one has 256 stars in it. She gradually weeded them out. She thought she'd get a lot of matches. She didn't get any. And pretty soon she was getting rid of the stars that other astronomers said wouldn't have planets. Finally, she was able to identify all the pattern stars. It's talked about in the book Captured, and the key thing is the base stars, Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticuli that I mentioned earlier, 39.3 light years away, eighth of a light year apart from each other, and a cool billion years older than the sun. That's impressive to me. And I met with Marjorie, and I was the first to publish about her work. And Kathy has all of Betty's papers and stuff. Betty's gone now, of course. I had met Marnie and Betty. So it's a challenge. And I'd sell you a copy, but I don't have any here because my box didn't get here. It isn't fair. There's Kathleen Marden, Betty's niece. She knew about it the day after it happened because Betty called her mother. And she was in the room when that happened. And so she's really done an enormous amount of work transcribing all the hypnosis tapes, etc. Gives a good lecture, too. Roswell. That's the state of New Mexico, right over there, close to you guys. Well, quite a drive. Roswell is in the southeastern corner of the state. That yellow area is the largest military base in the United States, White Sands Missile Range. And I tell people that, you know, at the end of the war, any aliens visiting here would know that there were three good reasons to expect that soon the Earthlings would be going to the stars. One of them was nuclear weapons. One of them was powerful rockets, the German V-2, which was being tested in White Sands. That's where we tested our first nuclear weapon. And radar, which is the beginning of the electronics revolution. We had our best radar there because sometimes the rockets went south instead of north. The Mexican government wasn't very happy about that. There weren't bombs on board these rockets, but you still don't want somebody splattering, you know, your local countryside with rockets. And I tell people, there's only one place in the world where you could study all three of those areas of technology in 1947, southeastern New Mexico, Roswell plus White Sands. And incidentally, in April, I will be part of a tour of New Mexico. The nuclear weapons test place is open 2 days a year. The first Saturday in April and the first Saturday in October. So if you want to see that nuclear weapon test site, no, it's not dangerously radioactive or anything. But it's kind of neat to be able to see where this took place. There's still a chance to do it. Sign up now. There's my book about Roswell. And, you know, one of the crazy criticisms I get, now, come on, Stan, why would all those Roswell witnesses go running to you with their story? The simple answer is they didn't. Well, how'd you find out about it? Didn't they come to you? No. I was at a television station in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Supposed to do three interviews promoting my lecture that night at Louisiana State University. And I'd done the first two. This is in 1978. And the third reporter was nowhere to be found. This is before cell phones and stuff. So the station manager is giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch. He knew I had other things to do. Out of the blue, he says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. For an investigator that I am, I said, who's he? His next sentence changed my life. He handled wreckage of one of those saucers you were interested in when he was in the military. What? And he wasn't joking. I mean, we were just the two of us. He was very serious. Well, what do you know about him? Well, he lives in Houma. I didn't know where Houma was. That didn't help me much. He's a great guy. We're old ham radio buddies. You ought to talk to him. The reporter showed up. I did my thing. I was busy the rest of the day. The next day from the airport, I figured things went so well. I called information, got a number for Jesse Marcel. It's before the internet. And he told me a story because I mentioned Bill Allen, the guy who was the station manager. And that got me started. And I shared this with a colleague. And I heard another story after another lecture in Bemidji, Minnesota. And my colleague Bill Moore had a third story out of an English publication where somebody was driving across the United States and heard about a crash saucer in New Mexico in 1947. Jesse didn't have the exact date. And I knew 1947 was a big year for UFO sightings. So that third story, English actor, hears on the radio about saucer crash in New Mexico. He had a date. How often would you take a trip from Los Angeles to Philadelphia back then? You can imagine what the roads were like. I'm sure you can imagine, as a matter of fact. Because he would have gone through Texas in 1947. Anyway, early July 1947, Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library, Periodicals Department. There was a story. Verified what Jesse had told us, told me. Gave us a bunch more names, and in the next year and a half, we found 62 people in connection with that event. Kept us busy. The first book came out in 1980. We kept at it by 1986. It was 92 people. And so if one of the lucky, and sure, you get lucky. I'm not saying this is all sheer talent. I called the Roswell, I looked it up, and I, no, there's a newspaper in Roswell. What do I know from Roswell? The Roswell Daily Record. So I called, asked for the editor from 1947. This is in 1978. Oh, long gone. What do you need? Well, I've got articles here that say the base public information officer, Walter Haut, Haut, his name is spelled four different ways in the press coverage, talked about a crash sausage. Before I could finish the sentence, oh, his wife works here. What? You don't expect the GI from Chicago, mind you, as I found out later, to still be in Roswell, where he was based in 1947. His daughter's been running the museum, the UFO museum in Roswell, incidentally. Anyway, talked to the wife, talked to Walter. He was a great help. He had a copy of the base yearbook, like a high school yearbook, and list, had pictures and names, and he remembered a lot of the people. So we worked hard to find a lot of those people. They didn't come running to me. It's sweat is the big effort it takes to do this sort of stuff. Anyway, and yeah, since then I've had a few people contact me. They knew I was involved with the Roswell investigation. But they weren't looking for anything. Jesse wasn't. See, Jesse Marcel could not deny, as I found out later, his involvement because his name and picture were in a lot of newspapers. I didn't know that when I talked to him. But it's true. Even a Chinese newspaper had Jesse's picture. It was a very big story for 2 days. But it's still a story now, after a little delay in there. So, if you know somebody who knows something about Roswell, and is still alive, I have trouble with the dead ones, but I don't know how to reach them, but that's a different area of the paranormal from mine. People are reluctant to speak, and I understand that. I had a clearance for 14 years, and people say, well, surely these guys all told their wives. No. The MJ-12 guys, of course they didn't tell their wife. I've never told my wife anything classified. Be crazy to do that. I can't control what she's going to say to somebody else. You take an oath, you protect your oath. Anybody here have a clearance ever in the military? Raise a hand if anybody has. Just real quick. Okay, I won't tell anybody. I think you know what I mean when I say you don't open your mouth when you shouldn't. Not even to your wife. Any wives out there, sorry about that, but you're not letting on everything going on. Okay. Now, this story's been around, the Aztec story, since, the 50s. And it was disgraced and discarded and so forth. But then the two authors of this new book just came out a few months ago. I wrote the foreword. I had a few copies over here. Suzanne and Scott Ramsey really dug into this, spent a ton of money finding documents, finding people. And look, you people here in the radio know that you don't talk to outsiders very casually coming to, say, a small town away from the big cities. In other words, if you fly into someplace near Aztec and you start opening your mouth, there aren't many people who are going to talk to you. They don't want to. Why should they? They haven't had good experience with people making big noises. So Suzanne, her family lives up that area. They got to know a lot of people and eventually got to a lot of prime witnesses. This happened in March of 1948. And this was a big one, about 90-some feet in diameter. One of the key questions, supposedly it was carried from there to Los Alamos. And people said, oh, there's no way you could get it there. It's a big old thing. Well, suppose it was cut into three pieces. Well, come on, look at the roads. So Scott hired somebody whose job it was to plan travel for large mechanical components, generators and stuff like that. You know, power plants, they've got big stuff. And you got to worry about, you know, whether there's a bridge, a tunnel, tight roads, et cetera, et cetera. They went over the route, looked at the old maps. This guy didn't believe in flying saucers, but he had to concede when they finally got finished. Yes, with the technology then available, they could have moved this from Aztec to Los Alamos. Why Los Alamos? Because it's a major laboratory with all kinds of capability. Usually 7,000, 8,000 people work there. I recommend the book because it's going to shock a few people. They've been flying, dropping out of the sky all along the way here, it looks like. Now, there's another case in Brazil, incidentally, Varginha. which I heard about when I was down there. And a lot of good work been done on that one. So alien zero defects program doesn't work. Sometimes they make mistakes, just like the rest of us. Aztec is in the northwest corner, the Four Corners area, where New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, and Nevada come together there. It's out in the middle of nowhere, frankly. A story broke this year. Strange story. A guy named Chase Brandon, the guy on the left, came forward to say that he worked for the CIA, and when he was in a closed facility, he saw a box marked Roswell, so he opened it up. He had the clearance. And inside found convincing evidence that Roswell really happened. He's not going to tell you the details of what he found. The other guy in the picture on the right is Lee Spiegel. Works for Huffington Post and posts a lot of material. He's been around a long time. He arranged the United Nations hearings on UFOs in 1978. I was part of that. Anyway, he met with Chase Brandon. And we have since found out that, indeed, Chase did work for the CIA and was close to the movie industry, which needs advice from government people on how to portray things and so forth. And that story got a lot of attention. Some people say, well, obvious nonsense. My first reaction was, Chase Brandon? The producer of my movie, UFOs Are Real, was Brandon Chase, which seemed real coincidence. But I just, 4 days ago, was looking at a book, a novel, in which the acknowledgments were given to various government people who had helped out. It was a spy kind of novel. And one of the people listed was Chase Brandon of the CIA. He definitely worked for the CIA, no question about it. And he still isn't telling anybody what the actual details of what he saw were. You know anybody else like that? Tell them to call me. This is that science was wrong. All those false claims by smart people of what was impossible. And I can't sell you one because they didn't arrive. This one came out last year, and it's got 13 chapters. I wrote two of them. The other 11 were by 11 different people. Our publisher put together this compilation. Leslie Kane, oh no, this is John Alexander. He says there is no cover-up. He knows everybody in Washington, and he asked a lot of people where the secret work is going on. And he said that he couldn't find any evidence that there was any secret outfit, no MJ-12 or anybody like that. And I asked him, still haven't gotten an answer. I said, John, you had a high-level clearance. How many times did you tell people who didn't have a need to know and an appropriate clearance, what you knew that was classified? And I think the answer is zero. But he wrote a book in which he says myths. He realized, he says flying saucers are real, but there's no MJ-12, there's no group collecting this information. It's just, they don't care. I strongly disagree. Here's a good book. Leslie is, she's a top-notch reporter. And she's got in this book testimony from generals and pilots from all over the world in their own words. And it's powerful stuff. When you read a top-notch general in Iran, whose pilots chased the UFO, and then something came out of the UFO, went back and chased the pilots, powerful stuff. It's always nice to be recognized by your peers. This, what I'm holding there is I was inducted into the Roswell UFO Hall of Fame. And the local paper carried an article about it, and the cartoonist went to town with that. I thought that's kind of nice, frankly. I mean, if you're going to have a cartoon, at least it should be friendly. And kind of the bottom line here, where do we fit in the universe? We will spend $1 trillion this year, we Earthlings. We have a lousy track record. We would be a menace to all those in our neighborhood. Thanks for listening. I'll try to answer your questions. Thank you very much. where would be a good place for the motherships to be hidden? Under the water? Well, it's a guy, anyway, he's got a book out about USOs underwater or unidentified submerged objects. He's got over 1,000 accounts from all over the world of objects going into the water or coming out of it. And if these things work by magneto aerodynamics, it could work in water too, because seawater is an electrically conducting fluid. That would be one place. There are plenty unexplored places on the planet if you're able to fly wherever you darn please. You know, jungles and so forth, rivers, wherever. We think we know a lot about the planet, but we only know about the places that are sort of occupied by people in general. They also might be on the backside of the moon. That's a good point. Convenient place because it's hard for us to see there. Unless you believe that we have a base on the moon, on the backside of the moon. Front side wouldn't do you any good. You know. Other questions? Yes. Tonight, I will show some pictures of an electromagnetic submarine invented by Dr. Stuart Way of Westinghouse Research Labs. No moving parts, and his students at University of California, Santa Barbara, actually built an electromagnetic submarine. There was an article in Time magazine about it, technical papers presented at professional society meetings, and the Japanese built one using superconducting magnets from Kawasaki, who's the big Japanese firm. I think it's Kawasaki. And these things work, but there's an old law of physics. If you have electric and magnetic fields at right angles to each other, you have a force at right angles to both. And you push against it, and by Newton's law, it pushes back, and you go slipping silently through the seawater. And you say, what's that got to do with in the air? Well, if you ionize the air to produce the glow, you can interact with electric and magnetic fields and control lift, heating, sonic boom production, radar profile. Those are kind of nifty things. Well, back in 1970, when I was starting on what sounded like it would be the best job of my life, I was offered a job at McDonnell Douglas Astronautics. You want me to look away? Okay. My job was going to be to figure out how flying saucers worked. And I was driving across the country when I found out that the program was canceled. It was part of the MOLE program, Manned Orbiting Laboratory. But one of the things I did get done in the 3 months they were nice enough to keep me on, having driven across the country to join them, what a greeting when you go to the business office, hear my offer letter, you realize we just laid off 5,000 people. Yes, I do realize that. Anyway, one of the things I had done was a literature search of the government report literature using one keyword, magneto aerodynamics. Got 900 references. 90% were classified. Somebody was paying a lot of attention. That wasn't the general open scientific literature. That was just government literature. You got a contract, you got to write a report, you know, quarterly report, semi-annual report, annual report. So, yeah, I think you can get around all the problems of high-speed flight. It wouldn't be cheap. These things never are. So I think magneto aerodynamics, and I talked about it in my congressional testimony, as a matter of fact, gave references. This isn't blue sky. I mean, somebody thought, wouldn't it be a great idea if blah, blah, blah. Experimental results. So if there's anybody here who worked on one of those programs, I'd like to hear about it. It was classified back then, I guess. Other question. Yes, way in the back. Why would the government deny this? Flying saucers? I mean, why don't they tell us what they know, those blankety-blank guys? Let me give you 6 reasons. And fear of panic is not one of them. People always bring up Orson Welles, you know, War of the Worlds, all that kind of stuff. First reason is you want to figure out how the darn things work. They make wonderful weapons delivery and defense systems. Can fly circles around anything we got flying. You see your secret project. You've got wreckage. You send out parts to some of the best labs, classified labs in the country. rule number one for security. You can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. They read the newspapers, listen to the radio, etc. Second problem, the other side of the same coin. What if somebody else figured out how they worked before we did? They're seen all over the world. How do we defend against them? We don't want them to know. We know they know. Weapon, counter-weapon, counter-counter-weapon. We've been playing this game a long time. Bigger spears, stronger shields, you know, same difference. Third problem is different. What if there were an announcement tomorrow by two highly trusted individuals around the world? A little hard to find, but my favorite couple would be the Pope and the Queen. They're about the same age. What if they were to go public saying we have an unreliable authority that our planet is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft? What would happen? The stock market would go down. Mental hospital admissions would go up. You know, all kinds of things like that would happen. But I think one of the things that would happen is that the younger generation, who, unlike me, was never alive when there wasn't a space program, you don't realize how anti the notion of space travel was back, let's say, in the 40s. Family member, he's a smart kid, but why is he talking about space? Something a little off, was the attitude kind of thing. Anyway, for the younger generation, I think one of the first reactions, based on over 600 college talks, is that the push should be toward an earthling orientation for all of us. It's obviously from an alien viewpoint that we're, you know, we're all Americans, Peruvians, Greeks, Chinese, whatever you want. But from a sensible viewpoint, you say, from an alien viewpoint, we're all earthlings. Like it or not, we don't seem to like it very much. I know of no government on this planet that wants its people to owe their allegiance to the planet instead of that individual government. Nationalism is the only game in town. When I live in Canada, we got Quebec wanting to be its own country, too. The next problem is a little different. Pat Robertson. You're all familiar with Pat, I gather. He has loudly proclaimed, the only intelligent life in the universe is here on planet Earth. I don't know how anybody could make such a stupid statement, but anyway. All this UFO stuff is the work of the devil, he said. Well, he'd be up the creek without a religious paddle if some announcement were to be made with me. The fifth problem is people said to me, Stan, look, if they're coming here and we're not going there, that means they're more advanced technologically than we are, right? Yes. Well, it's going to be an economic disaster. I mean, pretty soon we'll replace oil with something better. There go the oil companies. Ground transport, air transport, there go those companies. Computers, communication system, economic chaos. And I say, yeah, there's some truth to that. We're not making many buggy whips anymore, but I think we can survive it. The sixth reason, on seven different occasions, I have quietly heard from people telling me that they were aware of military pilots who went up to chase UFOs who never came back. If I've heard seven such stories, there are a lot more of them out there. And I get different reactions to that. People say, well, surely they would have told families. No. As a matter of fact, there's a book, By Any Means Necessary, talking about 166 American military, Air Force actually, guys whose job it was just after the war, late 40s, early 50s mostly, to tickle the radar over Korea, China, and Russia. Dash in and see how quickly the radar came on, what frequency it was used, and so forth. And we had radio communications from these guys. A whole bunch of planes got shot down. Nothing in the press. The families were told nothing. Unfortunate accident. Plane went down at sea. Sorry. Until 2001, they called a conference in which they brought in the families, gave them the medals their sons brothers, whatever it was, had earned, and told them what happened to them. 166 military veterans. Of course, I didn't say we shot down some Russian planes, too, and didn't say anything about those either. This is what happens in Cold Wars. They get hot once in a while. So, if they can keep that secret, and I should add, of course, that orders were issued. This is documented in the newspapers. 1952, when that big wave of sightings went on, pilots were ordered, shoot them down if they don't land when instructed to do so. Now, you can think of all the cartoons, you know, down and, you know, what the other symbol would be. But if we knew what was going on, we'd think a lot differently about this whole thing. One case was very interesting. A guy he's as old as I am, I guess. He was a Navy pilot on duty in South Carolina, sitting around doing nothing, really, but they got a contact from the air control outfit, bogey in sight, you know, so he was scrambled. Dashes out at 10 o'clock at night, dashes into the airplane that's always kept waiting for him, talks to the guys on the radio, and is scrambled. Up he goes, gets up 20,000 feet. Where is he? They tell him he's down below, and suddenly the craft comes up straight and then toward him. And a beam of light comes at him. He put up his hand. You can see the bones in his hand, which must be a pretty crazy sensation. And what's he going to do? Well, he's going to shoot at the darn thing because it's attacking him. Pulls the trigger and nothing happened because the guns hadn't been loaded. Now, the guy on the ground is listening to all this discussion, standard practice. And the UFO goes its way. He lands. He gets interrogated for hours by guys in suits and guys in uniforms, finding out exactly what happened and so forth. And I've talked to this guy, very sharp guy. And like I say, he went on to be a lawyer. I'm not going to hold that against him. And it was fascinating to talk to him because we agreed. The only reason he was alive is because his guns hadn't been loaded. And as I said, if I've heard of seven such stories, there's got to be a lot more out there. People had to tell somebody, and I seem trustworthy because I'm willing to stick my neck out, you know. So, there's a whole bunch of stories out there that haven't been told. Any other questions? We're just about out of time. Yes. Yes, I'm familiar with Dr. Stephen Greer and the Disclosure Project. Well, I've known Steve for a long time. I've heard him speak. I've read his stuff. And I don't trust him. He's made a lot of claims that haven't been substantiated. And, he talked about free energy having been developed and told you to invest in a certain company because they'd be building these devices. It's never happened. That was years ago. There are other claims like that, when he brings out flash searchlights and tries to bring in the UFOs, and when people who were there at the same occasion say they didn't see what he claims that was seen. It's a long story, and I'm not trying to make a point of attacking him. That's why I didn't bring him up. But if you're going to ask me, I'm going to tell you. Three comments, one question. Okay. About Steve Greer. Oh, there's a big mountain in California called Shasta. Yes, very big mountain. It's supposedly the home of all kinds of crazy things going on, to tell you the truth. It's a big mountain. I mean, it's 14,000 or so feet. And I've heard those stories. And I know that people have seen strange things up there, but I can't verify that there's a base or other things going on there. It's in my gray basket. Not enough data. Number two. Did you report this to anybody? We're getting a lot of reports of small things inside the house. Bright lights, scare the hell out of people sometimes. Because what is it? You're not accustomed to having things like that going around your room. Okay, you had a third. There are a lot of reports of strange phenomena in people's homes, for want of a better word. And we don't know what's going on. The aliens have some strange capabilities. One of them, and this really sounds weird, is to take people through solid walls. I've listened to a tape of a hypnosis session, and you can tell the woman is totally mystified. It went right through the wall. How could that be? You know, trying to make sense out of that. And sure, most of us is nothing. If you look at an atom and stuff, it's mostly nothing with a little something sprinkled around. But we don't know how they do that. They've got capabilities we don't seem to have yet. So I think it may be a manifestation of them. I mean, they're doing a thesis for their class. You know, alien technology, alien meaning us. Well, how are you going to find out more? Well, you put up your device inside their house, and you have sensors that send out signals. And I realize that sounds weird. But much of what we do today, look at this thing up here. If I had described the internet to you 60 years ago, what would you have said? Lock them up. You know, and Moore's Law, famous man, head of a big company, found out that the number of transistors you could put on a chip was doubling about every year or two, which doesn't sound like much until you multiply and multiply and multiply. And, you know, my wife went in to buy something for her computer. They were selling terabyte devices. You got kilobyte, megabyte, gigabyte, terabyte. Tremendous amount of information. You can store it in something this big. Incredible. Impossible. But we're moving in that direction. So there's a lot going on that indicates that our technology 20 years from now, I won't be around to see it, but it's going to be a hell of a lot different than it is now. And I don't know how to explain it. These guys are more advanced than we are. They know things we don't know. Sorry about that. Anyway, thank you very much.